Welcome to the debate. Modern civilization exists within a pretty profound paradox right now. On one hand, we possess just unprecedented scientific knowledge, technological capability, and, you know, economic capacity. I mean, we can edit genomes and we send rovers to Mars, yet simultaneously, the actual systems that sustain us, from climate stability and ecological integrity to institutional legitimacy and cultural cohesion, they are buckling under immense systemic strain.
Yeah, it is. It's a highly fragile moment. We are watching the architecture of our modern world experience stress tests on almost every front simultaneously.
Exactly. And that brings us to the core of our discussion today. We are examining the framework proposed by Dr. Bechara Sali in his work on the violence viability architecture. And this framework, it really forces us to confront a central question about civilizational collapse. When a society faces severe instability, what is the primary driver of that collapse? And therefore, what is the most critical point of intervention?
Right. Like, are we ultimately constrained by the ecological life ground, which is the biophysical natural foundation of a society? Or is institutional capacity, meaning the governance structures that manage these resources, the true linchpin of whether a civilization survives or falls?
Well, I argue that the ecological life ground is the fundamental determinant of civilizational viability. Physical, ecological limits dictate societal survival, period.
And I argue that institutional capacity is the true linchpin. How governance structures adapt to and actually manage that ecological stress is what actually determines whether a society collapses or survives.
So, to understand why the life ground is the absolute foundation of any civilization, we have to look at what civilizational infrastructure actually is. We often think of infrastructure as roads, banks, power grids. But the true infrastructure is the water cycle, it's the topsoil, it's stable climatic patterns, it is the physiological baseline of human existence.
I don't disagree that biology and ecology are foundational, sure. But I think you're underestimating the buffering capacity of human organization.
Well, let's look at the collapse of the classic Maya civilization as a perfect historical laboratory for this. The Maya had incredibly sophisticated political systems. They had monumental architecture that honestly still baffles engineers today, and highly advanced agricultural knowledge. Yet, archaeological and paleoclimatic evidence shows that a series of severe droughts in the 9th century triggered their total collapse.
They certainly faced a massive climate anomaly, but wasn't their political system already quite rigid by that point?
It was complex, yeah. But the rigidity didn't cause the drought. The drought exposed the absolute limits of the system. This was a profound life ground disturbance. Without water, agricultural productivity failed. The elites, whose political legitimacy was entirely tied to their ability to maintain cosmic balance and agricultural prosperity, they simply could not negotiate with a dry sky.
So you're saying the ecological limit just overrode all their institutional sophistication?
Completely. Warfare increased, populations dispersed, and the higher order institutions inevitably collapsed. It was cascading fragility triggered fundamentally by ecological limits. And Dr. Sawahi introduces a concept here called life value ontoaxiology. It sounds incredibly dense, I know, but it really just means that the ultimate purpose of any civilization is merely to sustain and expand life capacities.
Right. A society's actual values in keeping people alive and thriving?
Exactly. A policy or an institution only has value if it enables a more coherently inclusive range of thought, feeling, and action. But you cannot have thought, feeling, or action without water, food, and air. Physical limits are the absolute constraint. If the life ground fails, everything built on top of it crumbles, no matter how clever the institutions are.
The Maya case is instructive, I'll give you that. But the conclusion you draw from it obscures the actual mechanics of civilizational failure. We don't have to look back to the 9th century. Let us look at a modern equivalent discussed in the framework, which is the Syrian Civil War.
A deeply tragic and highly complex conflict.
Absolutely, and one with a very strong ecological component. Between 2006 and 2010, Syria experienced one of the most severe droughts in its recorded history. Hundreds of thousands of rural agricultural workers were displaced. That is undeniably a life-ground disruption, just like the Maya faced. But why did it become a catastrophic civil war?
Well, because the carrying capacity of the land was decimated. People were starving and migrating en masse to the cities.
It was not simply because the rain stopped. It was because pre-existing institutional constraints, I'm talking massive economic inequality, skyrocketing unemployment, and an absolute failure of administrative coordination, rendered the state completely incapable of absorbing those displaced populations into the urban centers.
Are you suggesting the drought was secondary?
I'm suggesting that physical constraints only become civilizational crises when institutions fail to manage them. Dr. Salih provides a really vital tool here called the constraint diagnostic flow. It forces us to distinguish between physical resource scarcity and institutional barriers to problem solving.
Okay, break that distinction down for me. How does that work in practice?
So a shortage of resources, like a lack of rainfall, that is an ecological constraint. But the inability to equitably distribute the remaining resources or the failure to adapt our infrastructure to new realities, that is an institutional choice. The institution is the bottleneck. The environment provides the challenge, yes, but it is the governance structure that dictates whether that challenge results in adaptation or violent collapse.
I see the distinction you're drawing there, but let me give you a different perspective on how these failures actually sequence themselves. You characterized institutional failure in Syria as a choice, almost as if it's independent of the ecological reality. Let's look at this through Johann Gelting's violence triangle, which this framework beautifully integrates with the concept of the life ground.
Gelting's triangle looks at direct, structural, and cultural violence, correct?
Exactly. And the key takeaway is that systemic stress originates bottom up. Direct violence, the armed conflict, the literal shooting we saw in Syria, is just the visible apex of the triangle. Beneath that is structural violence. That is where institutions systematically fail to provide basic life necessities to marginalized groups.
And I would argue that structural violence is entirely a failure of institutional design.
But my point is that when the life ground degrades to a severe enough degree, it practically forces institutions into structural violence. The pie shrinks so drastically that institutions which were built and stabilized for a certain carrying capacity structurally fail to distribute life necessities equitably.
I don't think they are forced into it. They fail to adapt.
The drought in Syria didn't just pose a manageable policy challenge. It shattered the material basis upon which Syrian institutions were operating. Institutional failure isn't a completely independent variable. It is a direct downstream consequence of the life ground collapsing under its feet. When the water disappears, structural violence is practically inevitable, and direct violence is the guarantee.
I come at it from a different way. Structural violence is not forced by nature. It is inherently an institutional choice, a failure of design and political will. Let's look at the formal sketch of the viability function provided in the architecture.
You're talking about the equation for civilizational survival.
Yes. Think of civilizational viability like a simple multiplication problem. Viability is a multiplicative function of ecology, institutions, and culture. You have life ground integrity, multiplied by institutional capacity, multiplied by cultural cohesion. Because it is multiplicative, the math tells a very profound story.
Well, if it's multiplication, then if any single variable is zero, the whole equation is zero, which directly supports my point about the life ground.
But look at how it plays out in reality. You can have a relatively abundant life ground, a high number on the ecological side, but if your institutional capacity drops near zero because of corruption, extreme inequality, or poor resource management, the overall viability of the civilization drops to zero.
Right. A society starving in a fertile land.
Precisely. People starve not because there is no food, but because the institution fails to distribute it. Conversely, societies with incredibly constrained physical environments, think of communities living in extreme arid deserts or the Arctic, they can maintain long-term viability if their institutional capacity is exceptionally high.
They widen their margin of error.
Yes. they expand what is called the viability corridor. The width of that corridor is dictated heavily by institutional design. Institutions are the regulatory layer that translates raw ecological realities into social organization. If structural violence occurs, it is because the regulatory layer failed to adapt its distributive mechanisms to the new ecological reality. It is a failure of the steering wheel, not just a bump in the terrain.
That brings us to a crucial element of the framework, which I think completely undercuts the idea that humans can just rationally steer their way out of ecological collapse. We are not just rational calculators, we are biological organisms. Our civilizational cognition is biologically founded.
You're referring to the psychological impacts of resource scarcity.
Deeper than psychology, physiology. Dr. Saheli utilizes the polyvagal model of social regulation. When a population is deprived of physical safety, when the life ground fails to provide food, water, or climate stability, the human nervous system biologically shifts into defensive neural states. We move from social engagement to sympathetic activation. We go into literal survival mode.
Like what happens during a panic?
Exactly. Think about a micro example, like the early days of the COVID-19 pandemic. The moment people felt their basic physical supply lines were threatened, rationality vanished, and people were physically fighting over toilet paper in supermarkets. Now multiply that panic to a civilizational scale over a decade-long drought.
The fight-or-flight response just takes over governance.
Yes. This biological threat response automatically triggers what the framework calls cultural attractors of conflict. Specifically, we see societies default to CMT, chosenness, myth, trauma, and DMA.
DMA being dualism, Manichaeism, and Armageddon. Manichaeism is a heavy word there. Let's unpack what that actually looks like on the ground.
It means pure us versus them. Pure good versus pure evil. The population stops thinking rationally about resource distribution and starts viewing the world as an existential zero-sum struggle. They engage in repression projection, which basically means blaming external groups or minorities for their own internal resource scarcity.
Scapegoating, driven by biological panic?
Precisely. You cannot institute complex, reflexive governance when the population is biologically locked into a state of physiological terror due to ecological scarcity. Securing the physical life ground is a strict biological prerequisite for peace and rational governance. You cannot pass a policy to fix a nervous system that is in a dorsal vagal shutdown.
That's a compelling argument, but have you considered what actually generates that required perception of safety in the first place? It is not just raw, unmediated nature. Nature is chaotic.
But nature provides the baseline calories and hydration.
True, but what buffers us from nature's chaos is the civil commons. Dr. Saheli explicitly defines the civil commons as the network of public institutions that provide universal access to life necessities. We are talking about public health systems, water infrastructure, unemployment benefits, and emergency response grids.
So you view the civil commons as a shock absorber.
Exactly. These are the actual safety-generating systems of a society. Nature has droughts, storms, and massive fluctuations. It is the institution of the civil commons that buffers the human nervous system from the raw volatility of the life ground. When you have robust institutions, you maintain the perception of safety even during periods of ecological scarcity.
But only up to a point. A shock absorber can only take so large of a pothole before it breaks.
But if that shock absorber works, the culture doesn't panic. Because those institutions maintain that physiological safety, the culture can maintain what the framework calls an HDT orientation: holism, dialectics, and transcendence.
Meaning they look for integrative solutions rather than devolving into the us versus them of repression and projection.
Right. They can calmly examine opposing perspectives and adapt. The biological state you are talking about is entirely mediated by institutional architecture. If the civil commons are strong, a drought doesn't automatically trigger the dualism, Manichaeism, Armageddon panic. The population trusts that the institutions will manage the shortage equitably.
I see why you think that, but let me give you a different perspective on the scale of what we are actually dealing with. Your argument makes sense for localized historical crises, but it drastically underestimates the scale of the crises we are currently facing. We are operating in the Anthropocene.
The era where human activity is the dominant influence on climate and the environment?
Exactly. We are not just dealing with localized droughts or a bad harvest anymore. We are dealing with the destabilization of planetary biogeochemical cycles, the carbon cycle, the nitrogen cycle, ocean acidification. When we talk about governance in this era, planetary stewardship of the physical Earth system has to be the most urgent priority.
Which I agree with, but how do we achieve that without institutions?
Because we cannot institutionalize our way out of hard ecological limits on a planetary scale. If the biosphere's regenerative capacity collapses, no amount of institutional buffering, no beautifully designed civil commons will save us. The life ground is not just the terrain we drive on. It is the non-negotiable substrate of reality.
But recognizing that substrate requires a scientific apparatus.
We have to prioritize immediate physical stabilization of ecosystems first, securing global water systems, protecting biodiversity, halting climate instability. Without that immediate physical stabilization, talking about institutional learning and shared reality knowledge systems is like rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. If the hull is breached and the ocean is pouring in, your governance structure is meaningless. The physical limits of the Earth system simply do not care about our policies.
I'm sorry, but I just don't buy that. Let me tell you why. You were demanding planetary stewardship, and you were right to demand it. But how exactly do you think planetary stewardship is achieved? It is not achieved by nature magically healing itself. It is achieved exclusively through reflexive governance.
Reflexive meaning governance that can learn and correct itself.
Yes. You cannot protect the Earth system without incredibly sophisticated institutions capable of continuous learning, adaptation, and global coordination. Dr. Sahali makes a fascinating point here about our species transitioning from unconscious evolution to conscious civilization.
But conscious civilization still requires a habitable planet.
Of course. But we need shared reality knowledge systems, meaning international scientific bodies, satellite data monitoring networks, and robust educational systems to even perceive the planetary boundaries you are talking about. We cannot manage what we cannot measure and agree upon.
So you're saying the institution is the sensory organ of the civilization?
Beautifully put, yes. This is where the viability dashboard concept becomes critical. A civilization can only survive if its governance structures consciously monitor ecological, institutional, and cultural indicators, and then adapt their policies accordingly. You say the physical limits don't care about our policies. That is true, but our policies are the absolute only mechanism we have to ensure we don't breach those physical limits in the first place.
I hear that. It's a fair point.
The institution is the consciousness of the civilization. Without reflexive institutions translating ecological data into equitable social organization, we are just blind organisms consuming our habitat until we die.
But notice what you just said right there at the end. We are blind organisms consuming our habitat until we die, unless we institute policies to stop it. The ultimate, final constraint remains the habitat. If the habitat is gone, the organism is gone.
But the habitat only disappears if the organism lacks the foresight to manage it.
Let me synthesize my position today based on everything we've covered. The ecological life ground is the absolute, non-negotiable substrate of civilization. Everything else, our economies, our cultures, our governance structures, even our civil commons, is entirely derivative of that biophysical foundation.
The foundation upon which the house is built.
Yes. And when that life ground is severely disrupted, as we saw with the Maya, the physiological threat biologically forces human populations into defensive, polarized cultural attractors. It triggers inevitable structural and direct violence. Therefore, our primary metric for success moving forward must be the life value policy test. Every single public policy must be judged primarily on whether it ensures the biological survival and ecological integrity of the system. If we do not stabilize the physical life ground first, civilizational viability isn't just difficult, it is mathematically impossible.
And to synthesize my counterposition, civilization is fundamentally defined by its adaptive capacity.
not just its raw resource wealth. Raw ecological abundance is entirely useless if a society's institutions cannot distribute it equitably. And conversely, ecological scarcity does not guarantee violent collapse if a society has the governance to adapt.
The width of the viability corridor.
Exactly. The true marker of a viable civilization is robust, reflexive institutions. It is the civil commons that generates the physiological safety required for populations to maintain cooperative, holistic cultural narratives rather than descending into scapegoating and panic. Without these institutions, even minor environmental fluctuations will tear a society apart from the inside out. The steering wheel, our governance, is what ultimately determines whether we crash or navigate the viability corridor safely.
I think where we absolutely converge today is on the terrifying reality of cascading fragility. This framework makes it abundantly clear that civilizational collapse is rarely a single isolated event. It is a cascade across all layers: ecology, institutions, and culture.
Yes, precisely. We are currently operating dangerously close to the edges of our viability corridor. Whether the initial crack forms in the ecological life ground, as you fear, or in our democratic institutions, as I fear, the feedback loops will accelerate the collapse across the entire civilizational architecture if we do not build systemic resilience.
Viewing civilization not merely as an economy or a political state, but as a living, multi-layered architecture is a profound paradigm shift. There are incredibly deep avenues for exploration in this material regarding how we measure and monitor these interacting layers. We will leave it to the listener to decide which layer of this architecture demands the most urgent intervention to secure the future of our civilization.